Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, we turn our focus to the precarious path ahead for the Australian economy. And as always, there's plenty to talk about. As each state effectively runs its own race against the virus, with Victoria debatably unsure where the start line is, there is plenty of healthy public discourse about the short and medium term impacts of the lockdowns, alternative paths that could have been taken, and the subsequent knock-on effects of the Australian way of life. As the investment world also deliberates over the expected returns, both during and after this unforeseen and incomparable situation, all eyes are now on government policy decisions that offer the chance to prevent or exacerbate the indelible effects of the pandemic on the Australian economy. Here to discuss these remarkable times, we are very fortunate to be joined by Professor Richard Holden. Richard is Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Australian Business School and academic co-lead of the university's Grand Challenge on Inequality. He's also been on the faculty at the University of Chicago and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he's also received a PhD from Harvard University in 2006, where he was a Frank Knox Scholar. Professor Holden also regularly appears as a media commentator, and amongst being published in most major media mastheads, he also writes a weekly column analysing global economic data called Vital Signs for the Conversation. Professor Holden, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you on. And also joining us today to help answer the question, will the Australian economy bounce back? I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, of course, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or of course, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Now, Richard, perhaps just to get us started, would you mind offering just some background on yourself and how your experience in education has given you an opportunity to contribute so much to the present conversation?
Oh, well, thanks for your generous introduction, and that sort of gave a potted history of where I'm coming from. I was in the private sector for about 5 years doing mainly private equity and before that management consulting, but then pursued a PhD in the US and have been an academic economist ever since. But as you said, I write about economic issues in the Australian and global media fairly frequently, and obviously this year has been there's been a very dramatic set of events that have come about, and trying to understand what the implications of that are for the Australian economy has been extremely important and continues to be extremely important.
Excellent. I might hand over to Damien to get the ball rolling. Got a few dot points to cover off on today.
Yeah, sure. Talk about. Look, I guess the main thing we're trying to get is a bit of an investment outlook for these and how it relates. And it's always interesting, especially as markets are sort of dislocated from some of the economics at the moment, just trying to reconcile the two and work out where it's going. So I guess maybe if I could start by, Richard, just getting you to explain a little bit about the way you're seeing the economic crisis unfolding in terms of sort of supply shock leading to demand shock and I guess sort of just a higher level view of diagnosis of where the problem is, I suppose, as opposed to before we get into discussing solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a different kind of recession than ones we've tended to see in the past that might be strongest in our memory. So if you think back to the Great Depression, you know, you had a situation where there was obviously sort of a financial collapse involved. So if you think about the US with, you know, the banking system falling apart, there being a lot of bank failures, and a very what we've come to understand was a very counterproductive policy response. And that we've learned since that time that in those kinds of, if you like, demand-driven recessions, or where there's a big fall in aggregate demand in spending in the economy, that the thing you want to do is, rather than tighten belts, you want the government to spend a lot of money. You know, if you think about what happened in 2008, I was in the US at the time on the faculty at the University of Chicago, so I wasn't really familiar with the term GFC, which is called it the financial crisis over there. But that was also a situation where money markets, you know, froze up. So things like the commercial paper market and the repo market completely froze. And you had a version of Great Depression falls in, you know, what economists call aggregate demand. But because Ben Bernanke was Fed chair and he'd spent his whole academic life studying the lessons of the Great Depression, you know, he and many others led to a very good policy response, which kind of made that much less dramatic than it might otherwise have been. Now, this recession is really something that starts off with a massive supply shock. So we don't start off with financial market dislocation in the same way as we did in 2008. There's no subprime, there's no, you know, mortgage markets falling apart, you know, hedge funds failing, or that kind of thing. There's obviously here a huge supply shock, which is, you know, driven by COVID-19. And we have the two prongs to that, which is COVID-19 occurs and a whole bunch of people say, my God, I don't want to go out and spend money because I don't feel safe being outside of my home very much. And secondly, I don't know what's going to happen to the economy in the future. So now doesn't seem like a time to be you know, spending a lot of money. And then, of course, the government response, which understands that can't have a functioning economy if you have the virus running rampant. And so there are targeted lockdowns of various and varying degrees in different jurisdictions around the world to try and get that under control. So that is the recession that we have today that starts with a supply shock, but it really translates into a more typical Great Depression type scenario. So think for a minute about what would happen if we had a widely deployed vaccine, you know, in Australia, or even take the dream scenario where that happens throughout the world, you know, sometime next year. And we go back to a situation where now we have no COVID-19, but we have the damage that's been done to the world economy. Well, you've had really damaged personal, household and business balance sheets as a result of this. Spending is going to be much lower than it was before. And we're going to have a situation where once we've dealt with the supply shock even completely, we're in a kind of 1930s style environment or a 2008 environment where we have to worry about you know, consumer confidence, business confidence, overall spending, and what needs to be done then. And so that's what I mean by saying, you know, this is a sort of a recession that starts with a supply shock, but it creates its own demand shocks.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, we've been arguing the case that that the world economy is getting close to the end of the cycle anyway. And I guess if you look back at you know, various crises, if you're going to have a sort of crisis that's not economic related, it seems that if you have it at close to the bottom of an economic cycle already, you know, the damage isn't as much, and then you can sort of come out of you can sort of come out of it. Whereas if you're already in this overly indebted situation, and you might have actually been headed for some sort of debt crisis at some stage anyway, from due to over-debtedness, that can then make things worse. I guess your thoughts on that how much of the damage do you think will be from what you're speaking about, and how much of the damage do you think will be from the fact that we started from a particularly over indebted situation to start with?
Well, I think you're right. We started in bad shape. And I think that comes in sort of two forms in a way. So one is exactly what you're talking about in various jurisdictions. So we have, you know, huge household leverage in Australia, you know, a property market that, you know, it's hard to say whether it's a bubble or not, or overvalued or undervalued, but certainly with, you know, very, very high levels of household debt associated with very, very high levels of residential home prices. And so, you know, we had a position going into this, you know, the end of 2019, Australian households were highly indebted. And you might say, well, they had really big assets as well, but those big assets were largely residential property, and that's kind of worth whatever someone's willing to pay for it. So that's where we started. From a more macro perspective, we started from what former US Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has referred to for many years now as secular stagnation. So a macroeconomic environment where in most advanced economies, Australia being no exception, but certainly in the US and Western Europe and so on, we had a situation where there was a great deal of global savings from billionaires, from sovereign wealth funds, from endowments and pension funds, and in the Australian context, superannuation funds, chasing fewer and fewer large dollar productive investment opportunities. So, you know, once upon a time, to build something like US Steel or the railroad companies or even something like, you know, large banks or large telecommunication companies around the world, it took a lot of financial capital to do that. And now we're in a world where a company like Facebook comes about with a really, really good idea and a laptop in Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room at Harvard. And that's just a very different world when you can create a company that's worth hundreds of billions of dollars with a terrific idea and a small amount of financial capital. The implication for that is you end up with very low interest, very low real interest rates, very low inflation, and also lower GDP growth, real GDP growth as a result of that. And that secular stagnation world is a world where you have very low interest rates, growth is sluggish, real wages are very sluggish and stagnant. And that's been true for really 5 to 8 years prior to what we came to at the start of 2020. So I think both of those baselines were challenging enough in and of themselves without having COVID thrown into the mix.
And so, you know, Australia, obviously with very high levels of household debt, you know, in comparison to, say, the US, which was you know, reaching sort of cyclical peaks in terms of more about company debt. And I guess you could compare, I suppose, to Japan with government debt and Europe with just, a mishmash of a whole bunch of issues going on. Which do you think is the better starting point for entering a crisis like this, having, you know, companies that are having more gearing in companies or more gearing in households?
I think both companies and the households being highly leveraged is problematic. I think one of the good things for the policy response in Australia is that government debt was at very low levels. Now, we have a kind of peculiar view about debt and deficits on both sides of politics in Australia relative to the rest of the world, where, you know, the sort of view is any positive level of government debt as a percentage of GDP seems to be too much. But of course, we went into this crisis with government net debt at about 18% of GDP and the OECD average being, you know, well over 50% and plenty of countries being, you know, up towards 100% or even more. And so we had a lot of fiscal space as a country to respond to this crisis. And that's a very good thing. That's allowed things like JobKeeper and JobSeeker and various other support packages to be able to be done quickly and expansively. I think they should have been more expansive, but credit where it's due. I think the government acted very appropriately and quickly, which is important. You know, being slow is the same as being wrong when it comes to these sorts of things. And so that gave us a lot of space to do that. That's not to say, as you point out, that it's great to have over-leveraged businesses or households, and particularly with very leveraged households in Australia, the pullback in spending that comes as a result of households trying to repair their own balance sheets at a time when, you know, wages certainly aren't going up, unemployment is going up. It's very hard to repair household balance sheets in those circumstances. And since roughly 60% of GDP in Australia comes from household spending, consumer spending, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on GDP, quite apart from what the virus itself does.
Yeah, so I guess in a relative sense, you're saying if you had a choice, let's say we're going into this crisis and you had a choice to be in charge of a country with the same level of government debt and one that had an overgeared consumer versus one that had an overgeared company, and the opposite which do you think starting from a better position?
Yeah, I'd rather have low government debt and an over leveraged business sector or company sector than the household sector, because I think repairing household balance sheets is a lot more challenging, and dealing with over-leveraged companies, there are just more tools available. So, you know, in bankruptcy and insolvency tools, you know, debt swaps and debt forgiveness programs, you know, restructuring of debts and so on are all tools that you've got available to you as a policymaker there, which are just much more challenging than when it comes to household debt.
And you spoke, so you've done a bit of work on inequality. I know there's one, I don't know whether you read much of Michael Pettis, put a book out recently, sort of, what's his, Trade Wars Are, what's his book called? Anyway, so he's a sort of big push on the whole look. Inequality is a lot of the issue, and certainly some of the demand side is coming to the in that we sort of quite often spoken on this program about, you know, you give an extra $1,000 to Jenna Reinhart and it's being thrown on the pile, and you give an extra $1,000 to a homeless person and it's being spent as quickly as possible. So, and that's sort of part of the reason is we've sort of posited that the wider the inequality becomes, that then you continue on this this problem of not having enough demand. Is that something you'd agree with, or is it in terms of the way you're looking at this? I guess is that a key factor in terms of the demand, or is that just more of a side issue?
No, I think it's a very important factor, and I think you know, mainstream economists for many years and indeed decades now have come to the realization or started to appreciate and been more forthright in voicing the opinion that income inequality, at least, perhaps less so wealth inequality, not that that's not an important issue for a whole variety of reasons, but that income inequality is a drag on consumer spending. And because consumer spending is an important part of the economy, it's a drag on the economy more generally. I think there are quite legitimate policy differences about how to respond to that. So, you know, one way to get that spending up is by putting more dollars in the pockets of less well-off, lower income households and individuals in the population. And another way to do that is to have very high or confiscatory tax rates on higher income earners. I favour the former over the latter. So I think, you know, what we saw with the expansion of JobSeeker in Australia during the first months of this year was a good example of recognition of the fact that, you know, JobSeeker was really at an incredibly low level, just from a human dignity viewpoint. It was also at a very low level from a consumer spending viewpoint. And as you say, putting more dollars in the pockets of people on JobSeeker was money that was going to get spent. So in the language of economics, those folks have a very high marginal propensity to consume. And that, you know, that is a very effective way to boost spending in the economy, is by giving government support to people at the lower end of the income distribution. So I think it's certainly appreciated that that's a very important issue. I think the policy response, there's more disagreement about exactly how to do that in an appropriate and effective way.
Yeah, but I guess so. If there was a, you know, another $10 billion of top up to various programs along those perspective, you'd be treating that as much more effective for Australian economic growth than say a $10 billion tax cut for the highest income.
I'm not sure we have to choose, and so I had a piece in the Financial Review a few weeks ago where you have to love sub editors at newspapers. They're way better at coming up with catchy titles than I could ever be. I think the title was something along the lines of we should cut taxes like Friedman but spend like Keynes. And I think that's roughly right. The situation we're in at the moment, at least in Australia at this point in time, is the following. We've gone from having the second lowest company tax rate in the OECD to the second or third highest. And that isn't because we've been ratcheting it up. It's because others have been lowering theirs. And that's happened just sort of over the last couple of decades as a matter of creep. So I think we should, I've been on the record for a long time saying we should cut the company tax rate for all companies, big and small, to 25% tomorrow. And that the only mistake that the current government and you know, under various prime ministers have done is be so worried about the four-year forward estimate period that they wanted to do this at, you know, over a decade rather than saying, let's do it quickly. I think they should do it now. And I think we should also cut personal income tax rates in Australia along the lines of what the government has proposed with their phase two and phase three tax cuts. That is not to say two things. One, that we shouldn't be spending more along the lines of what JobSeeker is doing. I don't think that we're going to see JobSeeker be at its current level forevermore, nor do I think it should go back to its previous level forevermore. Somewhere in between it seems more sensible from both an economic and a human dignity point of view. And the second reason that we don't have to choose at this particular point in time is because we do have that fiscal slack, that those two things at this particular point in time are incredibly important for expanding the economic pie. It's not that because overall debt and deficits don't matter. It's not because we can print money without consequence. It's because we have the ability to issue more government debt and to do that at a very, very low interest rate. And so we can borrow for the Commonwealth government can borrow for 10 years at 90 basis points at less than 1%. So the government spends $200 billion in fiscal support. The carrying cost of that is $2 billion a year, $1.8 billion a year. And we shouldn't think about that debt as having to be paid back, but think about it as having to be shrunk away as a proportion of GDP over time. So I think that there are no free lunches, but we're in a situation where both company and individual tax cuts and aggressive fiscal spending both have very high economic returns at this point in time, and we have the capacity to do it.
Yeah, and negative return, negative real returns in terms of, you know, our targets. Well, they should be negative, you know, maybe not this quarter, but, you know, you'd like to think over 10 years that the RBA should be able to get somewhere at least close to its lower bound of 2%. And yes, so if we could borrow at 1.9, you know, effectively you, by not investing now as a government, you're basically saying, look, I don't think I can beat zero as a return.
Yeah, and if you can't beat zero as a return on physical infrastructure, then something's wrong. And we know from very good work by economists and other social scientists over the course of two or three decades that returns to, social infrastructure, investments in human capital, investments in other parts of what you might call sort of social infrastructure can be very high and very valuable. That doesn't make every single investment in education a good idea, but it makes a lot of them a good idea, and certainly ones that have positive rates of return rather than negative ones.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And so, Frydenberg came out recently and spoke about, you know, more deregulation and a return to sort of Thatcherism. And I guess from our view, we sort of go through this pendulum where, over long, long periods of time where the pendulum swings one direction in terms of lots of regulation and centralization. And we sort of hit that in the 60s and 70s and then sort of swung back the other way. And we'd sort of argue that it's been pushed a little bit too far in the other direction. I'd be interested to see whether your thoughts is that, you know, if we see lots of announcements about, I guess, more deregulation and trying to sell some more government assets off to the public, whether that's a positive sign for recovery or neutral or negative.
Well, I think you're exactly right that it's, as with tax rates, the starting point is crucial in all of this. So just as not every tax cut is a good idea, but if taxes are very high, tax cuts tend to be good ideas. Reductions in regulation when there's, large amounts of regulation tend to be good ideas, but that doesn't mean that they're always good ideas. Thatcher and Reagan did some things that I agree with and many things that I disagree with, but certainly at the point in time, they came to office, both regulation and taxes were very, very high and economically crippling levels, and that cutting both of those things was the right move from an economic perspective. Is regulation sort of too high in Australia? I think there's evidence to suggest that in some sectors it certainly is, in terms of whether it's building permits or ability to get construction projects off the ground. There seems to be evidence suggests that regulation is hampering those things, certainly in terms of, say, zoning regulations for residential housing and increasing housing supply. There really are quite stringent regulations which are out of whack with many other jurisdictions in the world, and people have talked for a long period of time about relaxing those. And of course, industrial relations, I think, is an area where we have a very highly regulated industrial relations system, and there are five working parties, five groups putting their heads together to try and think about what can be done to make those more effective. But those are obvious. That's an obvious area as well.
Mm. I mean, in terms of the housing side, though. I guess contrasting that versus some of the problems we've had in terms of the high-rise development side, is that it sort of seems as if there's possibly over-regulated in some areas and under-regulated in others. Would that be a fair description, or you think the problems sort of in terms of build quality and stuff like that is not is solvable in under the current situation?
No, I think you're right that there seems to be over-regulation in some areas and under-regulation in others. And so we have you know, as that points to this somewhat bizarre circumstance where we have very meaningful restrictions on housing supply, yet there have been instances that, you know, have been all too apparent and extremely concerning where, you know, high-rise buildings do manage to get built and some of them aren't up to standard and are essentially crumbling before their residents' eyes. And so that seems like the worst of both worlds. And so it also points to, I think, what you're highlighting there, which is that sort of a very broad view of kind of regulation bad or regulation good is probably misplaced. And it's a question of what types of regulation we're talking about and what the starting point for those is.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And so you're on record with in terms of land tax, and sort of I'm flagged in front that, you know, this is obviously a huge issue. You could probably spend a whole topic on as well. I guess I'm particularly interested in the likelihood of it happening, because I think for a long time it's been touted by many economists in Australia as saying this makes a lot of sense. Why do we need a stamp duty when, yeah, high upfront costs, stops people from moving, all that type of stuff, and we could just spread it out over a longer period of time and not put all the funding for state governments on people who happen to need to move versus people who, you know, are happy to live in the same house for 50 years. And so I guess what I'm really interested is whether you think there's actually any real movement in terms of the land tax in terms of actually getting implemented.
So I certainly hope that there will be, but as you point out, we're not going to have a change that involves abolishing stamp duty one day and establishing a land tax the next day. Mm. Someone who just paid stamp duty the day before is going to say, but I just wrote, you know, a very, very large check to the government and now you're asking me to essentially pay again immediately. Mm. And that's bad. That's bad economics as well as bad politics. On the other hand, you know, trying to have some kind of scheme that takes account of that needs to be done in a careful and thoughtful way. Something that I've written about and others have talked about is some kind of grandfathering scheme that might look like the following, which is we say tomorrow, look, when you next transact a property, you can choose as the purchaser to either pay stamp duty or pay land tax at a designated rate. And you choose. If you want to pay stamp duty, go ahead. If you want to pay land tax, fine. If you choose to pay land tax, then that property becomes forevermore what you might call a land tax property. And, you know, given our torrent system, that's easy to track. And then over time, everything becomes, you know, a land tax property over time. Someone who just bought a property and paid stamp duty on it, you know, is not going to pay land tax until they move, so they're not disadvantaged. Somebody buying in equally gets the choice. So, you know, the good thing about getting to choose between options A and B when A is the status quo is you can't be worse off. If you want to do something different, you know, if you want the status quo, keep the status quo. If you don't. So I think something along those lines, and as I say, many people have talked about that, I think something along those lines is a really practical way to do it. There's sort of two issues that come up with that. One is stamp duty is an incredibly important part of particularly the New South Wales and Victorian state government's revenue stream. And so if everyone did elect to move to land tax, there's going to be a period of time while that transition happens where state governments are behind. Now, ratings agencies are smart enough to realise that this is a good and efficiency-enhancing move. And if the budget takes a bit of red ink for a few years or many years, until that washes through, they shouldn't be penalised in terms of their credit rating or things like that, and they wouldn't be. And if governments really were concerned about that, they could securitise that future land tax revenue scheme so they could get paid up front for it or a portion of it up front if they were really concerned about that. The second thing that's, I think, more of a political economy concern is, you know, can governments essentially commit to have land tax at a reasonable rate, or will that get ratcheted up over time? And some proponents of land tax are fairly mainstream economists like myself, and some proponents of land tax are people who want a backdoor wealth tax. And they say, yeah, we know how this is going to go. We'll introduce it at some relatively low rate, like 1% or 0.8%, and over time we'll ratchet it up to have, you know, make it 7% and have some backdoor wealth tax. And that would be a bad outcome for all the reasons that wealth taxes are not a good idea. How you protect against that is a little more challenging. And the sort of political marketplace may take care of that. But I think that's another concern that people legitimately have when thinking about making that transition from stamp duty to land tax.
Yeah. Well, and also I guess it's the issue that people have to, if I turned around to a bunch of people next year and said, you know, okay, you've lived in this, you know, let's say there's a grandfather and you said, okay, you've lived in this place for 20 years since the last time you paid land tax, so you can start paying on those ones or even your new ones. It's a new tax that people have to pay, and they get to feel it coming out of their pocket every month or every quarter or whatever. Is obviously never a never a positive sign for people. The hidden ones are much easier to.
It's quite an interesting one though, because the selling point, I guess, is that most of the time land tax is amortized into the loan. So if you've got the prospect of not paying it, and rather flicking over to stamp duty rather, yeah. You've got the prospect of flicking over to a land duty that you can basically pay more for the house. So from a I guess an overall market perspective, potentially that's probably a bit of an upside sale into the property sector.
Yeah, well, that might indeed happen, and there are lots of wrinkles on that, which is you might imagine that markets will offer a product which is to bundle into your home loan your first 3 years of land tax being prepaid or something like that. And so, you know, how that exactly shakes out, the degree to which those benefits are split between buyers and sellers of properties, you know, remains to be seen. But it is one of those relatively few things where the efficiency rationale is certainly very clear. So I really think it just takes some political will. And I think in New South Wales, you've seen both sides of New South Wales state government say that they're in favour of doing something like this. I'm not exactly sure what Don Perrottet is waiting for, but you know, I don't think there'd be a lot of opposition to just doing it tomorrow if he wanted to actually get it done.
Mm. And do you think, I guess what you're saying is you think it's a reasonable likelihood then in the next little while in New South Wales? Or?
Well, I would have said it's a reasonable likelihood, but it was raised by the Treasurer and then nothing's happened. And I didn't see a lot of opposition to it. So, like I said, I mean, he's got plenty of things on his plate. So I don't mean to be critical, but I would have thought it was a really good possibility when he raised it. Mm. But I'm not exactly sure why it hasn't happened.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm thinking is introducing a new tax during a pandemic, probably, or even just changing a tax that people might perceive to be a new tax. It might be, as you said, it's a political problem, not an economic issue. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so along some of the same bits, so at what stage, obviously we've got low inflation at the moment, and we've spoken about, you know, there being a lot of money sloshing around the system and you know, governments starting to put, needing to spend more. At what stage do, the bond vigilantes and the people who, your sound money crew, what stage are they actually right? I mean, it would seem to me that we'd have to spend a hell of a lot more than what we're spending at the moment. But your view on at what stage it actually becomes an issue for inflation?
Yeah, I don't think there's a, and let's distinguish between inflation and interest rates on government debt. But I don't think there's a magic number for that. But I think Australia, whatever that number is. Australia is really, really, really far away from it at the moment. So I don't think we should be concerned at all about that. And the fact that the AOFM issued 30-year Australian government bonds at 1.94% recently in fairly significant quantities suggests that the market isn't worried about that really at all at this point. So I think we're really far away from it. The US is special because it's the world's global reserve currency, at least at the moment. And so the so-called exorbitant privilege that the US enjoys as a consequence of that means that they get a lot more latitude than other countries do, until they don't, you know, when they stop becoming the world's global reserve currency. My own view on that is that probably won't be sorely tested by this if there's a change of government in November in the US and more economically sensible people are put in charge, whatever one's politics are about US politics, I think that putting more economically sensible people in charge would be seen by markets as a good thing, but I don't think there's any particular worry there. And then I think you point to, you sort of then go to, well, what about Italy? What about Spain? And I think, you know, in countries like that, and I think there's real cause for concern there.
Mm. Yes. In terms of the, there's some, yeah, the other sort of, the last thing on the fiscal side of it, or the sort of the government policy side, is we've had a lot of changes to insolvencies globally, and, you know, even just people, you know, if you don't pay your rent, you can't get kicked out of your house, and bankruptcies. You know, we've been talking about this as being, it's a bit like a virus in a way that, you know, testing for, in that you know, you have bad actors out there who should go broke, but because they can hold on for a bit longer than they do, and they rack up as many debts as they can, and then the good guys actually start falling over because they look at their things and go, well, I can't afford it, and I've got all these hundreds of thousands of dollars outstanding to these bad guys, so I'll actually have to fall over. You know, I guess there's a so I sort of support certainly the short term nature of let's put this some of these bankruptcies on hold for a few months while the first stages of the virus happen. I guess I worry that the longer this goes on, the more we're going to start seeing the effects starting to ripple through the rest of the economy. Do you have, I guess, I'm assuming you've got, you'll have similar concerns, but I guess a lot of it's about time frame. Whether you think, oh no, look, it's all right to keep running for another year, you know, we can extend this for another 6 months or another 12 months and still not have any problems. Or is this something that you think is a more imminent issue that is going to have to start being dealt with in the near future?
So I definitely share that concern. And it's pretty hard to criticize the response that says, look, we're going to put a moratorium on evictions and accelerations of mortgages, you know, as of March this year. You then get into, as you point to, the difficult position as a policymaker, which is September starts coming into the picture, and you say, well, okay, do we let them lapse at that point, in which case there are going to be evictions and there are going to be, you know, mortgage foreclosures. That doesn't sound good. Okay, let's put them off for another 6 months, and it, you know, but as you say, at some point they can't keep getting put off. I think I distinguish between the concern about zombie firms and then about households, and the zombie firm thing's definitely a real concern. But just play out, I mean, I don't think this is going to happen, but let's just play out the really ugly scenario on the household side. And it's one of the reasons why I thought JobKeeper should have been larger and should have looked more like an 80 to 90% wage replacement up to a pretty generous cap. So take someone on average full-time weekly earnings in Australia. That's about $3,150 a month. And they, you know, they essentially lose their job and move on to JobKeeper at the start of the pandemic. Okay, so they've taken a 50% pay cut, give or take. Now, you know, good news, they can't get evicted from the property that they rent, and they and the banks can't foreclose on their property. But this isn't, you know, free money. This isn't a mortgage holiday or a rent holiday. It's accruing. And so we get to, you know, sort of now/September, and, you know, suppose that goes away and they've got $15,000 in back rent or back mortgage payments to make. Well, the very fact that their job was under that kind of pressure probably tells you that they may not have that money. And so they're in trouble. Now, maybe they took some money out of their super under that scheme, what have you, but they're in some kind of trouble. Now, imagine this drags on for an extended period of time, and we say, okay, it's March next year when these provisions roll off. Well, then they got $30,000 or some number in back rent or back mortgage payment. And unless the economy's recovered, you know, trouble, which is why it's been so important to get the virus under control. So there's some hope in New South Wales or economies like that that things might be significantly improved by then. You know, Victoria needs to get its kind of virus house in order before that can really happen. So that's, you know, the concern. Of course, the longer you extend it, the more pressure you put on the banking system. And at some point, you know, the bank says, well, you know, you've defaulted on your mortgage. And if that happens to a whole lot of people at once, you have a fire sale, and that's a disaster. Now, there's a lot of comforting things being said by the Reserve Bank Governor Phil Lowe and by the Treasurer and by the bank chief executives and board chair people that say, no, look, we've done these stress tests and we've got you know, very high profitability rates and very high cap, you know, we've had more capital behind our banks than we've ever had before. Those things are all true, but we've also got a financial crisis like we might not have seen for a very, very long time, if ever. And so I don't know how well the banking system will hold up to that. Now, I don't expect the governor of the Reserve Bank or the Treasurer to come out and say, question mark, the banking system, and it could be a bit shaky. But that's precisely what gives me some concern, is they're not going to say that. And nor is some bank CEO going to come out and say, well, I don't know about the other banks, but mine's in trouble. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. We know what happens. There is a bank run in the stock market, right? Hmm. That's exactly what happened in 2008 and 2009. So I harbour concerns about that. I think if we get back to a situation like, say, New South Wales or Queensland or Western Australia or South Australia is in now, in terms of having the virus under control, Victoria gets sorted out, we're able to open domestic borders, state borders again, and get back to a more functioning economy where some sectors, like the international tourism sector, which is about a quarter of the overall Australian tourism sector, it's very significant, but it's not the whole thing. The university sector, it's, you know, something close to my heart, but it's still going to be in a lot of trouble. But we get back to a better situation, then I think we can avoid a lot of this stuff. But there is a scenario there which is pretty scary. And once the banks are under real balance sheet pressure, then, you know, then there's big trouble.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And so, actually, before we get off the fiscal side as well, sorry, I should have actually asked in terms of the stimulus side. We spoke a little bit about tax cuts versus, and we talked about sort of having both. In terms of, direct industry support, where's your line on that as well, in terms of, you know, at what stage do you say, okay, we're paying whatever it is, job keepers to people in the international travel industry, and we just have to acknowledge that sector's not going to be the same size as what it was before, and it probably needs to shrink by, maybe it needs to shrink by 20%, maybe it's 50%, who knows what the right number is, but you know, at what stage do we actually make the decision and move on?
I think you're right, Dan. That's a wrenching kind of choice to have to make, or decision to have to make. I think we'll have some more visibility into the second quarter of next year around what the steady state might look like. So suppose we have a scenario where a vaccine has been developed and it's starting to be deployed worldwide. You know, that's sort of best case scenario, but it's doesn't seem implausible given what we're hearing. Suppose that starts happening, then I think you raise the really important long run point, which is international tourism ever going to be, you know, like it was before? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure anybody really does, but at some point, if it's not going to bounce back, or it's not going to bounce back for years and years and years, then you know, propping up that sector doesn't make sense anymore, and it looks more like, you know, the Australian car industry, where you need to transition people away from it in a thoughtful and helpful and constructive way. But you know, that's unlikely to be the Australian tourism industry is, you know, some part roughly three quarters domestic, one quarter international. International tourism isn't going to go away forevermore if a vaccine is found, and so, you know, there'll be some contraction there. Exactly how much and exactly over what time frame, I think, remains to be seen.
Mm. Okay, so jumping onto the monetary side, sorry, Tim, did you have something?
Oh, so I was just going to just finish off on that stimulus piece. Obviously, we've spoken a little bit about job seeker, job keeper, Richard. Another big one, well, for mine anyway, is the cash flow boost. Damien's sort of talking a little bit about the corporate sort of side, stimulus help. Have you looked into that much? Because for mine, it doesn't seem to get the airplay that I think the potential quantum of money that's been shifted. And for those listening at home, essentially the PAYG, obligations, you know, to pay the payroll income tax for the companies has basically been, you know, removed or, you know, reduced to zero for a couple of quarters
for small companies.
For small companies, that's right. Yeah. So, have you been following that much, Richard?
Yeah, I agree with you that it's been sort of underreported and is perhaps underappreciated. Although I'm sure small business owners out there appreciate it very much, understand, very grateful for it. That's hugely important. And I think the logic that, you know, if you're an ASX 50 company, you can use your balance sheet to be able, you know, you probably have revolving lines of credit. We know that early on in the crisis, a lot of those companies actually drew down those revolvers and dumped the cash on their balance sheet in anticipation of maybe not being able to access it when they wanted to. That's being relaxed a little bit now. But, you know, there are certainly more margins of adjustment for large companies, and for small businesses, that certainly wasn't the case. And so I think that was a very good and important policy response. And I certainly don't think we want to see that going away anytime soon, with the caveat that, as you both alluded to, not every coffee shop and Thai restaurant is going to make it through this, unfortunately. And exactly how you let that shake out in an orderly way that's sensitive to the economic and human impact of that, without propping up businesses that just aren't sustainable for too long a period of time, is a difficult and sort of vexed issue.
But do you think are we even trying for a solution at the moment? It doesn't seem to be. I certainly haven't seen too much about, you know, here's our plan for how we're transitioning it out of it. It just seems to be like, it seems like we might reach close to the mid-September, and then it'll be like, well, we don't actually have a plan, so let's just add another 3 months to everything. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's not an unfair characterization, which is something that's sort of along the lines of, I mean, let's think about the Australian calendar in all of this. And you get to September, does anyone want to be a politician that's responsible for massive business closures right before Christmas and January? Probably not. And so, not that there's ever really a great time to preside over that, but that might be the worst time to preside over it, and for good reason. And so you then sort of say, oh, let's worry about that in March or February of next year, and that's maybe when people worry about it. But as you say, at some point there's got to be a plan, and you know, this is going to be a very hard thing for the Prime Minister or Treasurer to stand up and have to say, but stand up and say, look, the reality is not every small business and some big businesses that were viable in 2019 are going to be viable in 2021, and we've got to talk about how to manage as best as possible that economic and social transition. And it's not unlike a steel town essentially having, you know, its major employer go out of business. And, you know, what are the ways to manage that transition? And not too many countries have managed that transition very well in terms of trade adjustment assistance. It's something everyone knew about, everyone did something about. I don't think anyone did particularly effectively. And we're going to have a version like that, but much more sort of metastasized throughout both the country and the economy. So I think it's a huge challenge and a very important thing. And we haven't heard a plan yet, as you say.
Yeah, which seems to indicate we'll probably just get some sort of addition to it. Yeah. Okay, monetary policy. So I guess we've espoused this view for a while that you know that. And I'm aware you've been to the, you know, you're alumnus of University of Chicago, so this might be heresy to you, but it does seem as if central bankers certainly, you know, they know that we can cut interest rates and get people to leverage up, we can raise rates to stop people from leveraging up, but we don't really have a way of getting people to actually deleverage. I don't know whether that's I guess what I'm saying. Do you think we've got this sort of structural problem in monetary policy to start with before we even started getting into issues of the current crisis?
I'm not sure I disagree with the statements you made, but I'm not sure I would say that I think that we've got a sort of a major problem with the operation of monetary policy. So I think monetary policy, the channels through which it's stimulated investment and borrowing, actually are pretty much unchanged. I think what we have entered is this secular stagnation world where it's quite plausible that the, you know, what economists refer to sometimes as the equilibrium real interest rate or the natural rate might be negative, in which case, what do you do if it's actually negative and you can't have particularly negative short-term or long-term interest rates? And so if that problem of the so-called zero lower bound on in the Australian context, the cash rate that the RBA sets, creates a very significant problem for them. And so I think that's the issue that we have with monetary policy now. We've seen in the US that quantitative easing, the bond buying programs to try and lower long-term interest rates were an important response to that, particularly in the sort of 2008-2009 period. And of course, we've seen the RBA pursue a related so-called non-conventional or unconventional monetary policy this year as a consequence of what's been going on. But the sort of general point, and Phil Lowe said this in his parliamentary testimony on last week, that there's only so much more that monetary policy in Australia can do. I think that's right.
Mm. So okay, so he's sort of been come out against negative interest rates, and I think the US has come out against negative interest rates as well. I guess is that something? So and but you've spoken about maybe as you said maybe the right level is negative, and is it something you think they might be forced to try in Australia, or you think that's sort of like one of the last things out of the monetary policy toolkit?
So I won't try and pretend to know what's in their heads, but I think if I were in their position, I would probably reason as follows, which is, okay, there are just some mechanical sort of market details about why you can't really practically have interest rates be too negative, but suppose we could get them to be negative 50 basis points or something like that. Suppose that was possible. And suppose we could even get to a point where people could have mortgage rates of, zero, or somehow we could engineer a situation where mortgage rates were negative, as we've seen a little bit in some European jurisdictions. What would happen? Well, given Australians' kind of love of property and obsession with property, what you might do is just, do what happened when they lowered positive interest rates, which is arguably fuel a housing price bubble.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's the most, all to each other, right? So, we go from swapping our houses for a median of $1 million each to swapping our houses for a median of $2 million each. I'm not sure really what that achieves. That's a sort of slight caricature of it, but maybe not so much. And so I think it's a little bit unclear what, another 50 basis points at this point in time does. I think that's actually more of an issue, not so much for the crisis, in the next year or two, but for the sort of longer term thing, which is if you do believe in the secular state nation thing as being secular, it's going to be around for a long time, then or indefinitely, then I think you are in a situation where, the governor talks about, doesn't see the cash rate moving for 3 years. I think there's a reasonable viewpoint that says the cash rate won't move for 10 years or longer.
Yep.
And then how you manage things like the inflation targeting regime and just the standard day-to-day workings of the RBA in an environment where the cash rate isn't a decision anymore. I think that presents some interesting and challenging questions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen that, arguably it's tongue in cheek, but it's sort of saying, well, if the RBA is not going to do anything for the next 5 years or 5 to 10 years, then and do they need to meet every quarter? If you just say that's
Yeah, I mean, I must say, as somebody who wrote columns very critical, I have great respect for the bank, and I have enormous respect for the governor and the deputy governor, Guy Debelle, and they're held in very high esteem by central bankers and economists around the world, and rightly so. But I was very critical of their unwillingness to cut rates, up until the middle of 2019. And yeah, so I certainly watched, and most market participants watched every month, first Tuesday of every month, with great interest and sort of, hitting refresh on the website and things like that to see what was going to happen. And now it's just a yawn. I couldn't even tell you when the next meeting is going to be or what the next announcement is going to be. You just know what it's going to be, which is we kept the cash rate on hold. Thanks. Next. So it's a big change in a short period of time.
So is there an option then to, as you say, to sort of come out and say, all right, we're going to have negative 25 basis points reserve bank rate for the next year or 2 years, and then use like an intermediary, like a macroprudential sort of approach through APRA, perhaps to be the handbrake, as it were, on property and lending? Would that be perhaps an alternative?
Yeah, that's definitely an alternative. Although, I don't think APRA's covered themselves in glory with their macroprudential management, right? So you might remember a few years ago, a fair few people were pretty agitated about interest-only loans, and I certainly was pretty concerned about them. And, they let interest-only loans get to the sort of remarkable position where You know, the chief executive of Westpac, almost in passing, said in front of a parliamentary committee, oh, yeah, our home loan book's like certainly more than 50% interest only, as if it wasn't even news. And people were like falling off their chairs, both inside and outside of the parliament as a result of that. And APRA sort of turns around and says, oh, you know what, this interest only thing's a real deal, and we're going to then put this ham-fisted cap on how to do it. And then, of course, you know, they had this thing where they wanted to, you know, constrain the amount that people could borrow. Then the housing market tipped down by sort of high single digits to low double digit percentage. And they said, oh, gee, that's bad. We better reverse course on that, pump some more. You know, we had a property bubble. We sort of cut it off. That's no good. Let's get back to bubble land. And so, yes, good macroprudential management is extremely important. I haven't seen a lot of that out of APRA, to be honest.
Yeah, I think we'd certainly second that. From I mean, I guess there's a lot of other countries that don't have APRA. Their versions of APRA and the RBA as separate entities, but rather as the same entity.
Well, and you know, there's a history there to that as well. It wasn't always the case in Australia either. And so I think there's, I must say, I don't really understand the rationale for having them be separate when they so clearly need to communicate with each other, and. You know, the Reserve Bank does a whole bunch of different things. The idea that they can't do macroprudential regulation as well, I'm yet to hear a clearly articulated rationale for why they should be separate.
Yeah, yes. Mm. You alluded a little bit earlier about some of these operation twists and I guess the targeting of the long end of the bond curve by the US Fed and ECB and others. Given the situation in Australia where, you know, so much of our mortgage lending is done at quite short time frames, whether it's, you know, 3 or 5 years is quite a long fixed term mortgage and most of it's done at the floating rates, variable rates. Do you think it's going to make much difference if the RBA does start to target that long end of the curve?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter so much for home loan rates, as you point out. I mean, it's sort of a point of contention about whether the US housing market is anomalous or the Australian housing market's anomalous to have, you know, 30-year fixed rates be the norm in one and kind of floating rates be the norm in a, you know, fully variable rates be the norm in another. Again, starting points, I think, matter in this, which is I would have said, you know, some years ago, it would be much better for the Australian housing market to have more of a norm of a 30-year fixed interest rate loan. Having said that, suppose somehow that norm just shifted overnight in Australia. Does that just lead to, you know, throwing fuel on the fire of a property bubble? Maybe it does. So I'm not really sure what the benefit of that is. But your point that suppose long-term interest rates are managed down through the RBA bond buying program, that might help some businesses. It doesn't obviously immediately help a lot of mortgage holders. And indeed, when asked in that testimony last week, Phil Lowe, when asked about, well, you know, why aren't you targeting, you know, beyond 3 years along the yield curve, he said, well, words to the effect of, well, you know, most corporates are borrowing at about 3 years. And that's true, but that's also endogenous to like what long-term interest rates are, obviously, and he understands that. And so if they did lower 10-year rates, maybe businesses would borrow 10 years, and maybe that would be good for financial stability. So I think there's more to be thought about there, but it's unlikely to affect the mortgage market a lot, or at least in a good way.
So do you think the RBA has got, let's say things get worse. Okay, let's go down our path of you know, the immunization vaccines that they're working on, you know, don't make it through the trials, and we're in the middle of next year and some of these things have rolled off and we're struggling with unemployment and a whole bunch of other things. The RBA has basically sort of said, look, we've done our job, it's over to you. Is, you know, at that point, I'm guessing there's going to be more pressure on them to do more. Do you think there's...
Yeah, I think there's definitely pressure on them to do more. I'm not really sure what they can do. So we might see them try negative interest rates. You know, I think that they could provide perhaps more forward guidance. So I think the language used by the governor in his public statements could give more guidance about, there really being very low interest rates for a very long period of time. And again, in his statements last week, he sort of said, well, I suppose we could try and, you know, lower 5-year or 10-year bond yields, but that would depend on what our view about the cash rate is going to be some years hence. And, yep. You know, that I listened to that and I think, well, he thinks that in 3 years the cash rate might be going up. And so that affects market expectations and borrowing rates and quantities, obviously. And so if he was to say, look, you know, it's going to be low for 10 years, you know, and we're going to be very clear about that, that would be something more that they could do.
If there was, if we actually did want to move to a situation where, I guess giving the RBA more powers in terms of, you know, are they allowed to print some money and give it to the government, or are they allowed to, you know, to fund a UBI or whatever, to some sort of variable UBI to get more money out directly to the people, helicopter money straight to the people, as a special sort of event to start kicking things back off again. How much change would need to be made within the Australian to the system and setup?
Well, I think mechanically not very much would need to change. I think it would be a very bad idea. I think that there's a very good reason why the Reserve Bank does not directly, if you like, monetize government debt. And why government debt, even if it's for a short period of time, like a week, does go into private hands. And it's because you get a price signal about that. And that price signal is extremely important for understanding exactly what you said about bond vigilantes previously. And once you lose that market price signal about that, you run the danger of not knowing that you've got an inflationary problem until you've got a very serious inflationary problem. And so, you know, I don't like to advertise voodoo economics to people who are not already familiar with it. But any of your listeners who haven't heard about so-called modern monetary theory, that's, you know, that's what many advocates of MMT want the governments to do.
Yep.
And the problem is the following, which is MMT has many failings, and I'm going to lead to, yeah, as I say this, I can just see my inbox filling up with hate mail because that happens every time I say stuff like this. Nonetheless, advocates of MMT do not have a theory. Among other things, they do not have a theory of inflation. They say inflation is the constraint on how much money you can print or how much debt you can issue. Fine. No standard classically or Keynesianly trained economist disagrees with that. But we have theories of that, about how inflation comes about. And assuming away the problem and saying, well, it's only a problem when it's a problem, is not very satisfactory. And it's not just Zimbabwe and Venezuela and Weimar Germany that have had hyperinflation. And it's not only countries like that that had very big inflation problems very quickly. It's some countries that managed to do something about it, but it's worth remembering that France in 1981 under François Mitterrand started to see inflation get completely out of control before reversing course extremely quickly and just in time. And in fact, Germany in the early 1990s, when Gerhard Schroeder was in charge, had the same thing happen. So it is not just a couple of quirky countries with dictators in charge of them where this thing becomes a problem. And it's hard to imagine in Australia where that becomes a problem. But, you know, once upon a time, there was a chance that Australia was going to default on its government debt. And once upon a time, inflation was out of control in Australia. And I don't think anyone wants to go back there. So the one thing that people like me and the advocates of MMT agree on is we should have very large fiscal spending in Australia. Okay.
Yes.
We should be doing a lot. Maybe we even agree on some level of tax cuts. I don't think we can afford a universal basic income at a level that's universal and a real income. You know, at $20,000 a person, that'd be more than the entire federal budget. I don't think that's sustainable. And quite apart from effects.
I'd also say, yeah, you also need to have a huge increase in your medical spending for all your drug addictions and all these, effectively a bunch of people you're saying to, we don't need you in society. Here's some money. Go and entertain yourself.
Yeah, for every undiscovered Mozart, I think you'll find a very large number of discovered opioid addicts. And so, but there are lots of reasons I've written about that to be skeptical of the UBI. But nonetheless, I really don't think we will try the printing money experiment in Australia. And, you know, to any MMT advocates who are just once again outraged by what I've just said, I'd ask you to focus on the common ground, which is I think job seekers should be higher. I think job keepers should be higher. I think there should be a lot more spending on social and physical infrastructure in Australia. And you don't need to be an MMT advocate to reach that conclusion. You can be someone who found a very happy home at the University of Chicago Economics School and still reach that conclusion.
Yeah, no, and I don't even add, the one I'd like to add in there is I feel as if there's a scope for more R&D spend as well in terms of these ones, in terms of current situation, saying, well, if I had a choice between, between paying out a bunch of money to people at the lowest end of our society, well, without denigrating them too much, but you know, the people who have decided we don't need these people to work, you can go and entertain yourself, versus saying, well, why don't we actually grab more of the middle class and throw them into research and development roles and pay higher salaries to that. And instead of them being baristas, they can come and have a science job, and we can, the people who we would have given a UBI to can come and be the barista or come and be the waiter for to actually incorporate them back into society.
I couldn't agree more. And Australia's overall spending on R&D as a percentage of GDP is historically low and is very low compared to a lot of other countries in the OECD. It's low compared to the OECD average, and it's very low compared to really leading countries like Israel. And it's something that we know exactly what policy levers need to be pulled to get that to be higher. I think businesses for it. I think universities are for it. And I think you pointed very articulately to a number of the social benefits that would flow from it.
Yeah, we just don't know the political levers to pull to get it there.
That I can't help with. No.
But look, that's excellent. Thanks a lot for your time, Richard. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add before we let Tim wind it up.
No, I think that's great. It's we covered a lot of ground, and I was very pleased to have the opportunity. So lovely to chat.
Yeah, look, fantastic. Yeah, really, really enjoyed that time. We've obviously got the fullness of an hour now, and you did promise that, so very thankful for that. Just on that final note, and obviously you may have said a cat amongst the pigeons, so I might just throw out, how can people get in touch with you and follow some of your work there, Richard?
I'm easily Googleable. I have a website with all my popular writings as well as my academic writings on it, so if you happen to be interested in what will look like recreational mathematics, that's under the research tab on my website. And if you're interested in some of the other things, my popular writings are there, and I have a column every Friday in The Conversation, which is, I think, a very worthy publication.
Excellent. Yeah, well, thanks again for coming along, and yeah, we really look forward to getting along to the show sometime soon as well. So thanks again.
Thank you.
So, Damien, terrific hour odd there spent with Professor Richard Holden. Great to have him on the show for the first time. What was your take?
Yeah, look, what was interesting is we obviously agree on a fair bit within that. I think there's certainly a lot of, we spoke a fair bit about the debt issues, the high household debt. And I think as hopefully it wasn't too much of a leading question to him, but you know, if the choice was saying if you had a higher corporate debt, a country with a higher corporate debt or a higher household debt, which one would you prefer to have? And you know, his answer was very much that he would prefer to have somewhere with a high corporate debt, because you know, you can write off those quite easily and move on to your next ones. Whereas having a high household debt, you know, really does take a long time to recover from. And Australia has a high household debt, so where you know that's the US, for example, has got a very high corporate debt, but the household isn't too bad. Whereas Australia is the opposite problem. The part as well about that, you know, people are just accruing the debt, so the debt's not really going away, it's just sort of sitting there, and that just means that the longer you extend this, the bigger the problem is going to be when you finally have to deal with it. I think what was quite interesting for me was this whole idea that and we've been hearing that a bit from everyone, to be honest, recently, is that the can's going to get kicked for another 6 months or so, and we've already seen the Victorian no evictions for another few months. Most of the restraints are starting. We're going to finish 30th of September, and this is the whole idea that you should have heard from the government by now what the transition period was going to be, and the fact that you haven't probably means that it will be kick down the further down the line, and that's just going to, to me, that's just going to create more problems. You can just see that very idea that, you know, you've got good actors and bad actors out there, or you know, even the bad actors might not even need to be that bad. They just think they're going to make it back, and they just keep running up more and more debts to people, and eventually they can end up bringing the good actors down as well. So if you've got somebody who ordinarily, you know, ran up a $5,000 bill with a supplier, couldn't pay, goes to the next supplier, by that time he's already in court, and he doesn't get to run up another $5,000 bill. Whereas now he can actually run a $20,000 bill up with the first supplier, go to the next one, run up another $20,000 bill, go to the next one, run up another $20,000 bill, all fine. He's not getting, can't be sent bankrupt. So that scenario, it means that you start having other people fall over because, and it starts sort of, circling through society. And similar with your rent evictions, if you can, somebody who doesn't pay the rent for a month or 2 months, is eventually kicked out. Whereas now, people can go 6 months or more, it's going to be 9 months in Victoria till people can be kicked out. 9 months, if you got a loan on that house, is a long time to wait to get paid for your rent.
That's right.
And sure, you can waive your own interest, but that's only accruing as well. So you got double the benefit. At the end of it, if the person genuinely can't pay because now they've got a $30,000 bill rather than a $15,000 bill, you're not getting any of that money. Well, you're getting a very small amount of it, and you're still on the hook for the interest.
And so how do these themes, I guess, translate then into our tactical or positioning in our portfolios or in our sort of stock selection?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, one of the things he did mention, is well worth noting, is that the RBA has been talking about the banks being strong, and APRA has been talking about the banks being strong. But as he said, they're not going to say if there is problems. That's one area we've been very much looking to reduce our exposure to, and keep pretty much minimum weights to that area, just on the whole back of this, that, if we're sitting in the eye of the storm, and the first part of it was, that we saw lots of layoffs and hugely reduced demand and all these shutdowns, you get this stimulus, now that would help balance things out. You sit in this eye of the storm. The next part of the storm that's coming is when you start seeing the redundancies, when you start seeing the bankruptcies and starting to flow through the rest of the economy, and the demand, actually see the demand hits and the government stimulus starts to roll off, that's where you see the problem. Within that, banks and areas, those stocks, plus there's other ones in similar sort of adjacent sectors that we look upon and say, well, you really do need to take what you're seeing there with a huge grain of salt, and look at the pricing that you're getting within that, and be very careful about what you're going to buy. I think within our, you spoke about the lower interest rates. We've certainly been on that case, and similar views in terms of our bonds. Having said that, though, we have recently taken a bit of profits in terms of the bonds. Not because I think he's wrong in the medium or longer term. We're just sort of taking the foot off the accelerator a little bit, and I guess we're as we see more vaccine announcements and we see more, I guess, positivity coming through, we're sort of expecting to see a little bit of a yield back up before we head lower again. So we're certainly not going underweight, but it's just one of those things in a low return world, which is where we are now. You just do need to make these changes if you want to make anything better than the cash rate. You just need to be a little bit tactical about when you're shifting into assets and when you're shifting back out of them. And that's just an example of, if you want to beat what's in the bank, you've got to, we'll trade up and trade back a little bit, but you sort of keep the same sort of core position, which is, yes, I want to be overweight, but, it's not completely overweight at this point in the time. The other thing he spoke about was just talking about the effects. The other big effect we've got sort of within stocks within our portfolios is that, if you buy the outlook that we've got that things aren't fixed and there's still problems to come, and it's just a matter of kicking the can down the road, and it's just a matter of actually waiting for these bankruptcies and the actual economic effect to really hit, is that you need to be very tactical about the stocks you want to buy as well. we've got this list of stocks where very high quality stocks that we think over the longer part of the cycle will give, you know, the next 5-10 years are going to give you some great returns. We used the first fall to pick up a few of those stocks and to switch our allocations around again. I think we'll certainly be using future volatility to do the same, because it's your opportunity when you see this volatility is saying, if you have the shopping list of like, here's a stock which I fundamentally like the outlook for the sector. We fundamentally think that there's a it hasn't got too much gearing, and there's a good long time frame, and the revenues are going to support the business even in the downtimes. You'll get a few shots when the markets take their tumble to buy those stocks, but they're not the type of thing if you sit around and say, oh yeah, that looks good, I'll come back in 6 months and maybe pick that up, because you know, as the last fall and bounce back showed, you know, a lot of those stocks just don't last at the lower price.
You're going in a fortnight.
Yeah, that's right. And they tend to be some of the first ones to be sold off because they are very liquid. Which sounds weird, but what generally tends to happen when you do get the panics and everyone starts to sell is that some of these really high quality stocks are very, very liquid, because there are people out there who always want to buy them. And so people that are just getting out of the market, they're the ones they tend to push out first, because they can. The liquidity is there. I can sell that. I've only got to take a 5% loss on that one. Whereas if I've got to sell these other stocks, I'm going to take a 10-15% loss on it. So they sell the ones quickly that they can get out. And that sort of tends to push those stocks down quite quickly. And then you have this sort of narrow opportunity where you're like, great, I can pick up these high quality stocks at those low prices before you sort of lose that opportunity. And because they're the ones that bounce back the fastest.
Very quick.
Once people start buying, they're like, well, if I can buy, you know, a Microsoft, or I can buy an Amazon or a Facebook or you know, a high quality stock at a cheap price, then I much prefer to grab that one rather than grabbing, say, a beaten down airline or a very cyclical company, which might be very cheap, but it's not like
could be cheap for a while.
Yeah, that's right. And it's the type of stock we sort of break our portfolio up into different things that we buy. And there's some stocks we buy because their average value, average quality, you know, just a normal stock standard security, but they're very, very, very cheap. And so you take the view that I'm happy to buy that. But as soon as it goes up, you're selling it, versus those really high quality stocks you want to stick in your portfolio and you want to own them, you know, pretty much forever. But the idea is that you want to use these opportunities to get in, lock in your lower price, and then you're comfortable as the stock runs up over time to keep holding to it and yeah, add to it when you get those opportunities.
Fantastic. All right, very good. Well, we'll look forward to hearing some more, hopefully, from Professor Holden in the future. I think he was a bit of a hit, and I think he's got plenty more to say on the topic as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, certainly agreed. Thanks.
Coming up next week, we have Australian economist and author Professor Steve Keane back on the show to give an update on his recent work on the hotly debated topic of modern monetary theory, or MMT, including building a mathematical model of the theory to test its reliability. For those that know Steve, we'll attest to his razor wit and common sense approach to economics. And as a treat, we will be shooting this live, so you can jump into the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time next Thursday, the 3rd of September, to have your questions of Steve answered live. It'll be great to see you there. And we hope you've enjoyed today's show. So if you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. And we also always appreciate guest or topic suggestions. So if you've got one, drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our podcast grow. Thanks very much for your attention today. It was a terrific show, and we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.